at Irregular Hours, episode 164 for the glorious 25th of May, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenfla. Did you say glorious?
Yes, it is the glorious 25th of May. Pam Bedore's here too. Hi, Pam.
Hi, I'm Pam Bedore.
Yes.
Why is today so glorious, Steve?
It's Geek Pride Day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Geek Pride Day 2021, the celebration of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's Towel Day, the glorious 25th of May. That is the Discworld by Terry Pratchett holiday. And it is the anniversary of the release of Star Wars in 1977. So happy Geek Pride Day, everyone. Go to geekprideday.net for all of the information.
Star Wars. I think that it's probably going to be passing.
Star Wars, Chip. Star Wars. But we're here not for Geek Pride Day because it's the last day of school. That's why it's not Geek Pride Day on the show. It is instead the last conversation that we will have about The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Kowal, the alternative history that, gets us up into space this week, Chip.
Are we going to make it on to Mars at some point?
Spoilers, yes.
So you guys, what did you think of this? I mean, this is book one of three. Are you guys going to read the other two? Do you feel like it has a good standalone quality? Or is it like one of those strong book ones where you're like, I need to move forward right away?
Let's have Steve answer that real quickly.
In my opinion, this is the first half of this story. I really believe that Mary Robinette Kowal wrote a 800-page story for the Lady Astronaut, for Elma. This is the first half of it. This is all of the introduction of all of the characters. We get all of the little moments. And here at the end of this book, she gets into space. The Faded Sky, which is the second book in the series, was released a month later in August of 2018. And that one's got all of the space action movie that Chip has been waiting for.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be getting to that second part, but I am glad that we read this first part.
Now that you're primed and ready, that's astronaut terms, for getting into space, you're not going to read the space adventure that you've been waiting for?
Yeah, don't tell the author that. But yes.
How about you, Pam? Are you going to immediately get into The Faded Sky?
Maybe not immediately, but I will eventually. I've got a bunch of things I have to read right away. But yes, I will eventually. I am curious where she's going to go with this. I really like the alternate history sort of quality to it. The way that she's commenting, just like a utopian or dystopian writer would, commenting on our current society by looking at this alternative. And she's really interested in questions of gender and race, which are questions that really interest me too. So I will read on.
Now, in 2020, she did release the third in this series. It's called The Relentless Moon. That one is a true sequel. It's a whole new cast of characters with all new issues and problems. And maybe, Chip, maybe they get to Mars on that one.
Well, maybe they will. And I look forward to hearing about it.
Not to reading it.
And not to reading it. Got it.
Although, but I will say, like, for me, I find it very intellectually stimulating, but I can easily go to read something else right now and then come back to it. I'm not like, oh, what's gonna happen next? I feel like they will be successful. I have every confidence in these characters to beat climate change.
I wish I could share your optimism. I mean, this is a huge, we talked about this when we read the climate change book, the scope of what we're talking about with this adventure, trying to save humanity, that is so huge a scope that getting to Mars is such a little step in that whole idea of saving humanity. I do suggest the second book for those of you who have been reading along with us. I do suggest the second book. It is full of space adventure and all of the things that could possibly go wrong. We get a little bit of that in this book, where the astronauts who are in space are flummoxed by a washer of all things, and they can't get the washer and they have to figure out what to do. And then we've got that space action movie where they go to the space station instead of to the moon where they were planning to go, or wherever they were planning. I forgot already where they were planning to go. Maybe they were coming home. They get to the space station to just in a nick of time, and they're saved by math.
As people often are. You know, I kind of like the realistic details about the space program. Not only the politics, which we'll talk about a decent amount this episode, but also just about the math. I really like this quotation. To put this into perspective, the Sirius has 5,600,000 parts and close to a million systems, subsystems, and assemblies. Even if everything was 99.9% reliable, that would still be 5,600 defects. It wasn't a question of if something would go wrong on the way to the moon. It was a question of when and what. And I really like just thinking about the math, how complicated these systems are. Over 5 million parts. I mean, of course things will go wrong. And I really like how they have these big binders, because of course, this is before really the computer age. I mean, they have some basic computers, but not anything like what we have. So they have these gigantic binders of scenarios, how you pull up the correct redundancy for various part malfunctions. I love that. I just, space, I mean, it's just such a crazy context for science.
And that idea that they have thought through every possible scenario here. We get a lot of conversation about the nervousness of the adventure of sending someone into space. The rocket could at any point explode and those people could die. And they know that, and their families know that. But the idea that these brilliant people have been working on every possible scenario, and they've got that paperwork there ready to be pulled off the shelf when that particular thing happens. It's really reassuring when I think about the space program in general, that NASA has thought that through. Some brilliant person in the structure has a plan for that. I wish that life was like that. I wish that I had a plan, a scenario for every possible thing that could go wrong. But I think I would drive myself mad doing that.
I think the Cylons had a plan, Steve.
No, they didn't have a plan. There was no plan. The Cylon, that was a lie. The Cylons had no plan.
Oh, the Cylons had a plan. But anyway, I really also like the detail that they keep the families in this isolated space. So that if, in fact, as you just noted, Steve, the rocket blows up upon launch, then the media can't actually capture people's grief before they're ready to be captured. And so, you know, these are the kinds of details. And I think that part of what Elma is telling us is, guys, the math is too big for us to have considered every possibility. With 5.6 million parts, you know, you can't actually game out all of the different combinations that could go wrong. If you know there's going to be 5,000 defects with a 99.9% effectiveness rate, you cannot game that out. So you can come up with lots of good possible solutions and problems, but you can't get them all.
Mm-hmm. We do get in this section to the actual lady astronaut, right? We finally actually get that Elma is on the list to be a part of the astronaut program, and all of these other lady astronauts are there too, and we get a little bit of what Chip was hoping for, that training sequence where they all get their training and testing, and hopefully they have all the information that they need. Did you enjoy that part of it when it finally came up, Chip?
Well, I felt that it should have been a montage. Yeah, it could have been action music, a lot of push-ups, running up mountains, you know.
And wearing totally inappropriate clothing while exactly. flight simulations.
Kind of like Baywatch, right?
Oh, and that struck me as so ludicrously, ridiculously possible.
did you find comfort in the idea that because they made these women wear bikinis for this test, the test was actually easier for Elma than in the flight suit because she could feel the fabric on her skin instead of through the flight suit, and so that test was that much easier for her?
No, Steve, I did not find comfort in sexual discrimination in the workplace, but thanks for asking.
And for the record, I'm wearing a Speedo as we're recording. There we go.
No, Steve... Sorry, that was a horrible response. No, but I think that part of what Kawal is saying, and this kind of moment happens a lot of times, right? Where someone tries to intimidate Elma or to create a situation that is discriminatory. And she, like a lot of women, she's like, okay, well, you know, this is how I'm going to get past this. And hey, little silver lining you didn't think of, buddy. I mean, this is actually, I thought that rang so true, that she's so frustrated that this is what she has to do. But at the same time, she's like, ha, didn't think of this, did you? So I did like it.
A little bit. Even though it's uncomfortable, the author here is showing us this uncomfortable moment that is a typical uncomfortable moment.
And it's very good writing.
It's very good writing. But on the other hand, did you feel that the different ladies who are the lady astronauts were separate characters? Did you get a sense of each of them from the reading?
I wouldn't want to take a quiz on, you know, who's Nicole, who's Helen. I mean, they weren't as distinct as they might have been for me. And I was reading the hard copy, so I wonder if it was a little more distinct. I felt like the dialogue lines were similar. The people didn't have like super distinct voices through dialogue, but in the Audible book, I bet it was more easy to distinguish.
Yeah, I think that the I listened to Audible, and I think what the reader was doing for us was giving accents to the different characters that helped distinguish them a little bit. But, you know, that means that the reader had to read through the material and go, yeah, they kind of sound similar. We need to figure out a way to distinguish them so that we can keep them straight as we go through. But if you sat there and said, okay, Chip, which one's what, which one? I don't know. I got through the material. I thought that the story was compelling enough in the sense that it moved forward, but it was nothing like I was riveted to learn more about one particular character over the others.
Okay, so Pam, just to decode, when Chip says, I got through the material, that's usually code for he didn't like it very much. He says that often.
Gathering that.
Again, the narrator on the Audible is the author. She is a professional voice actor. She is a puppeteer. She did put her passion into the voice of these characters, and she didn't have to do a lot of research because she already did the research by writing these characters. I wonder what percentage of her writing she's thinking of how to voice these characters in the audiobook.
That's a great question. Yeah, that's cool. That's so cool that she's like a voice actor as well as a writer. That is really interesting.
I really admire the ability that she has to give us the distinct accents and distinct characters in her audio version of this. I can understand. I see what you mean. On the page, their stories are virtually the same, you know, with small details here and there. But when we listen to it on the audio, it does make a little bit of a difference.
That makes sense. And I actually really thought it was super interesting, the selection process. And you guys, like, I don't know very much about NASA, but I bet this always happens. Like when they choose a crew, there are all these other people who feel like they were more qualified. I mean, there's so many elements that would go into the choosing of a crew. And so I think she does a really great job of setting that up for us. So immediately after it is announced who the lady astronauts will be, they get their letters and all. Elma and Nicole, who is the senator's wife, they argue about the fairness of the selection process. And Nicole is kind of pragmatic about it. She said, it's all about the story that the IAC wants to tell. Nicole shrugged and took a sip of her martini. That's what politics is, stories. And the story that they want to tell doesn't include Black people? I winced, realizing I'd cut Helen out of the equation. Or Taiwanese? Just white people. And so it's like, I think this really great moment, there's so much there, where Elma is really, she has such a, I don't want to say naive, but maybe hopeful way of thinking about the world. Like, I'm sure they'll pick the very most qualified person, and that could be a woman. And despite the fact that we have seen her be victimized by not only sexual harassment, but also substantial gender discrimination, she kind of keeps that hopefulness about her. Whereas Nicole, a senator's wife, is like, girl, this is how it works, right? You got chosen, I got chosen. Hey, she doesn't say your husband is the lead engineer to Elma, but she does say my husband is a senator and Violette's husband is an astronaut. Do you think it's like a total shock that three of the six women who have been chosen have like husbands who are majorly involved in this? And then there's Betty, the reporter, and Jakira, the Brazilian beauty queen. And Jakira's really, she's in the same boat as Nicole. She's like, you know what? There were four Brazilians with very similar qualifications. I happen to be a beauty queen.
That's one of the biases, right? Beauty bias is a thing. And the unconscious biases that we encounter that we might not be aware of, that idea of the best person for the job is so clouded by our perspective on how that bias, you might not understand why you are biased, but you are biased. And we all have to see that in order to try to get the best candidates. The idea of the politics of this is certainly a part of every job, isn't it? Every job interview, you have to think about how does this look if we hire this person versus this person.
Having been on the hiring committee side many times, as I'm sure you guys have been, you don't know, right? So you meet people and you try to picture what they'll be like in the job, what they'll be like, you know, in whatever you're looking for, what they'll be like as a colleague, as a worker, as a representative, as an astronaut, like whatever you're looking at. It's a very complicated question of how you choose people for jobs. And it's one that I think Kowal does a really nice job of showing us. And I find it interesting that Elma seems to have this real imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Same time as she's complicated, which is what's so great about the character. She knows her math skills are like super superior, not just excellent, but completely superior. But she has these other weaknesses that very, very aware of.
And I think that's great writing. I still love this character throughout this conversation. And I still think that you and Chip would like this character in the action movie that is book two.
I will read it. Absolutely.
I look forward to hearing about it.
We've discussed it once already. I discussed it on the old show once, but we might get to it again on this show. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Now, how did you guys like the big ladies' bathroom scene?
There's a lot.
Yeah, Steve, tell us a little bit about that ladies' bathroom scene.
The conflict here, it certainly come to a boil here. And we, the reader, are seeing from all of these different perspectives, all of these different thoughts going into this. And then here finally is laid out all of the real conflict.
And I think that it was really funny to have this big scene in the ladies' bathroom, which is, of course, it kind of points to something that is becoming maybe a little bit less true today, but certainly in the 50s, that like that door that says ladies on it, that's an uncrossable boundary for a man, even though you just open the door and come in, buddy. But this is a place of great privacy. And it really captures how real this totally arbitrary signal, than the word lady or that silly picture of the silhouette in the skirt, that actually creates a barrier that is just as real as a padlock.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, and while all that's true, I can't help but think of Lyndon B. Johnson. He was president of the United States. He used to negotiate with people. And one of the ways he would do it is in the bathroom while he was using it. And so that was a power certainly. Play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Therefore, keeping women out of negotiations, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say mm-hmm. that. That scene was actually, that was lifted for House of Cards in the Netflix series. And Claire Underwood used that same tactic while she was negotiating something.
Hmm. There's that power play there, and the idea of the privacy of this room, that this is one of the only places where they can have true privacy. This really gets to a fiery conversation.
And what they do with that privacy is totally yell at each other. And I think it's really interesting because Elma actually approaches Betty, who she completely looks down on as unqualified. She's the life reporter. And Elma thinks, what is this woman going to be doing in space? This is crazy. But now Betty knows that Elma is taking anti-anxiety medication. So she says, listen, Betty, I am really sorry about having been mean to you earlier, but I need to ask you a favor. Betty says, it's not really an apology if it comes with a price tag. True, fair, says Elma. But then Betty continues, I wouldn't expect a Jew to give something away for free.
Well, that was interesting.
And I think what really fascinated me about that moment is that I think Elma sometimes forgets that even though we're so close to the end of World War II, she worries so much about her own unconscious discrimination, like just moments earlier when she was thinking about how she had left out her Black and Taiwanese friends, or had lumped together Black and Taiwanese as if that was a similar experience. And I think she forgets that, you know, people actually think of her as a Jew, and that's not always a positive thought.
The biases are so well spelled out.
Yes.
I applaud this author for being able to make us uncomfortable. That is an uncomfortable moment that we really look inward and go, wait, how many times have I made a similar uncomfortable gaffe? Not intentionally, not to be rude. This is intentional. This is intentional.
Rude
for sure. But how often do those perspectives blind us to the feelings of others? And that's done really well in that very powerful scene.
Similarly, I think she does a fantastic job of outlining the relationship between Parker and Elma. Now, I'm going to say something a little bit crazy about this relationship, so bear with me. So they've known each other a long time, and Elma has even accused him of sexual harassment in the past. Now, at this point in time, Elma finds out completely by accident that Parker is not fit to go into space. He actually has a problem with his left leg. It's simply not working. He would not pass the fitness test for space. Also, completely accidentally, Parker has found out that she's taking anti-anxiety meds. So it's very complicated. They sort of blackmail each other into not telling secrets, even though it's making them both crazy. And because they both seriously care about the space program, right? So on one hand, Elma pretty much hates Parker. At the same time, she is continually impressed by how fantastic he is as a teacher. And she herself, she's a brilliant mathematician, can't teach it at all. She tries to help people, but she sees it too fast. She cannot figure out a good way to explain things to people. And so there's this weird thing where there's almost like, you could imagine a version of this where they would like share a passionate kiss in the stairwell. Like the sort of sparks between them could have gone a different direction if you wanted. But Steve, you're not going to agree to that.
I'm not going to agree. No, no, you're not right, Pam. No, no.
I told you it was a crazy interpretation. I would be curious, though, if I'm the only person who noted that things got a little hot between them.
I think that the author, once again, is really good at writing characters. I think that the complex character of Parker, and have we gotten to his wife? Have we heard the explanation for why his wife is nope. never present? That's nope. in book two. Mm. That's in book two, where Parker is way more complicated than he is written here, even. I think this is how real communication happens between colleagues. Yes, he has a chip on his shoulder because she reported him for sexual harassment, which is something that probably would not have flown the same way in the 1950s, as the author is pointing out here. But the conflict between the two of them is so in depth that, yes, we get this weird relationship where they're blackmailing each other and taking care of each other because, honestly, they care about each other for their needs in the program. And we hear that, we see that from Elma's perspective.
And I think it's interesting that when they go up in the T-38, which she can't even believe that she gets to do that with him. This is like coolest plane, right?
Can we point out how amazing that moment was when she was just giddy with the idea of flying this machine?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So when she goes up and they start doing the flight checks and everything, she gets really anxious and she explains to the reader, that's right, I was less worried about a mistake killing me than I was about looking bad in front of Parker. My priorities were perhaps not what they should be. Perhaps not.
So is that where you're seeing that this could be a romantic encounter, the two of them?
I just thought throughout, I got these little kind of clues that I realized, like if we were reading Blake Crouch, for example, it felt like similar little clues that we were getting in the early parts of that book. Like, hey, there's like a little romance edge to this. And it felt like she was pulling up those cues.
Nah.
Now, and then they have their big blowout, of course, where Parker actually outs her. He flirts with outing her, and Elma just thinks, you know what? I can't do this anymore. And she outs herself. She says, hey, even I take anti-anxiety meds.
Can we talk about that scene for a second? Because
great scene, yeah.
I don't like that scene. I think that that is so anticlimactic. Like we have been, she's hiding, and she turns around and outs herself. I did not like that scene.
Why didn't you like it, Steve?
Because we've been with her this whole time going, if she's on medication, if she has an anxiety disorder, she can't be a part of this program. It is not going to happen. That outing where she goes ahead and says, oh yeah, I've been on this medication for weeks. Where does that go from there?
And you hit it right there, Steve. I don't know what it takes to become an astronaut, although I know that there is a stringent requirement to be able to physically and mentally be able to qualify for that. And the idea that that would not be known by at this point
mm-hmm.
just seems a little...
I think it would disqualify her. I really do. I really think that the author is throwing that out and going, okay, and she admitted it, so now it's okay. I don't think it would be okay.
So you were troubled by the realism element. You felt like that was an unrealistic decision. I think it's more unrealistic than nobody knows about it. I mean, it felt to me like Elma finally was like, you know what? I can't live like this. I can't live with this big secret. And also, I do think she like deeply cares about the space program as a way to save the human race. And so at a certain point, you got to say, listen, here's that thing you didn't know about me because you got to know it. Like, so to me, that felt completely realistic. You have to have the information. I can't imagine why she kept it so long.
That's maybe that's the issue. Maybe it was the secrecy. I don't like lies. I'm not available to listening to someone's lies. And the subterfuge of the lie, I mean, it affected her marriage. It affected all of her relationships. And then she just ends it. I think that's the thing that bothered me.
And I think she had finally made the right decision after being, you know, after like reacting through shame instead of integrity. I was really glad that she finally got pushed into making the right decision.
Okay.
But anyway, it's a great scene. I mean, whether you might not have enjoyed reading the scene, but it is a really great scene in terms of like keeping you on your toes. Now, she is eventually chosen to be one of the three in the first moon mission, although she'll be the one who stays in the spaceship. She's not going to walk on the moon. Now, did you guys think that was realistic? Compelling?
It seems like a foregone conclusion, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem like we are just, this is the character who is going to be the lady astronaut. And no matter what trials and travails she goes through, she's going to be on that ship. It seemed a little too easy and convenient, just kind of like the beginning of the story, where it was just a little bit too lucky that these characters made it through this emergency situation.
To be an astronaut is an incredible honor. I mean, to be able to qualify for it. You know, what your part of that mission is you have no control over it. It's, they're choosing for you in many ways. So I think that that's what happened when we think of when we, in our reality, landed on the moon. Yeah. And I think that that would be, you know, at that time, it would have been the same thing. So once again, it's just amazing that you're one of the few that get to do this.
And ironically, the astronaut who stayed in the ship on the first moon landing just passed away.
I saw that.
So how interesting that once again, this book club goes right up against the calendar and and there we are.
To give a little, hint in the future, our next read is going to have a little headlines too, Steve.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Oh boy. That's a tease. You're a tease, Mr. You're a tease.
Well, I don't know if I mentioned to you guys that I am right now on this giant Stephen King binge. I've read, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 novels in a row, and I'm on like a mission to catch up on a bunch of Stephen King novels that I've missed over the past decade. And the thing that you mentioned there, Steve, about that sort of element of luck in the beginning, that's something that I think Stephen King does amazingly well that Kowal didn't bother with, and I'm not blaming her for that. But when Stephen King has some sort of disaster, as he often does at the beginning of a novel, he shows us like 8 or 10 different perspectives on that disaster. And if he shows us 10, 9 of them end in death. And then 1 is the person who survives and goes on to have the big adventure and save or not save the world. And so he sets that up so beautifully. And that's an opportunity that she didn't take, partly because obviously it's a first person narrator, so you can't do that.
Right.
But I mean, come on, we don't want to read the story of someone who only survived 15 seconds after the meteorite hit, right?
Like, book.
Of course you're going to take the story of the person who ends up in space.
Obviously this is the
protagonist. But I know exactly what you mean though about like, she doesn't capture that realism that some authors really commit to in disaster fiction.
But she does give us the reasoning behind why Elma is the one who gets to be on the ship, and that's because of her math. Mm-hmm. They decide that, boy, we don't have the calculating power on board the ship. We need to send them with a calculator, and it just happens to be she is a calculator, and so we're going to send them up with the best tools that we have, and she's being used as a tool there, but it works for the character. It works for the reasoning.
Absolutely, and they call these characters a computer or
a did I said calculator instead of computer. No,
you're
right. They are computers. You are absolutely right. That's one of my speeches in computer classes. What's a computer? And they go, it's a thing you play games on. No, children. It is not a thing that you play games on. It's a thing that computes. That's what a computer does.
Including your brain has the ability to be a computer, dear children.
Not mine. It's a left brain, right brain thing. No.
So, should we go to the ending?
Ending. Okay.
You, but I liked the ending.
Okay, but again, I don't see this as an ending. I think this is the end of the first half of this story. But yes, fine. Tell us about the ending, Pam.
Make it stop.
Oh,
I'm teasing.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, Chip has been so can I say curmudgeonly? Is that
that's my job?
Chip has been so curmudgeonly for our last two climate crises novels. We are going to be curmudgeonly.
We're not going to read any more climate crisis novels. It's because of Chip. That's for sure. That's a tease.
All right. So in the final chapter, Elma just keeps repeating, "Today I am going into space." And then she says a few things. "Today I am going into space." Like, and I love that. That's a great technique. We can feel her enthusiasm, her excitement. She's wearing her astronaut diaper. She's, you know, she pulls us through like quite detailed events of exactly how everything is set up. And then it happens. And she is in space and she looks outside. And this is the ending of book one. The stars come out, millions of them in crisp, vivid splendor. These are not the stars that I remember from before the meteor. These are clear and steady, without an atmosphere to make them twinkle. Do you remember the first time you saw the stars again? I am sitting in a capsule on my way to the moon. Now, Chip, what do you think?
I really like that.
Yeah.
I like the simplicity of it. Uh-huh. I like that it there's a grandness that's part of it. And it really does set up, I mean, you've left your celestial home and you are now truly out where there's nothing holding you down. The gravity is not there.
You are unmoored.
And there is just not, I mean, at that point, you know, you truly have grown on an incredible way. So we went from our home to now the adventure begins.
Chip, one thing that I love about you is how you put things into second person all the time. You did not say Elma has grown. You did not say these characters have grown. You actually embodied what's happened in this story. The characters got to you in a way that you put yourself into this thinking.
Well, isn't that that's the purpose of stories? You can live 1,000 lives, but never leave your home.
So I think Chip actually liked this book in his own way.
His own curmudgeonly way. I love that you bring up second person, Steve, because that's what I wanted to say about this passage too. She suddenly switches from first person to second person. Do you remember the first time you saw the stars again? And that actually places us in the position of the audience of this book in alternate history. It's like she's speaking to people who are also going to be going into space one day.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, reader of the future, when you managed to see the stars, which haven't been very visible after the meteorite hit. It was after you left the atmosphere. So there's a real hopefulness, but it's subtle. But there is a real notion, like a lot of humans are going to be leaving Earth. And they're not only going to be seeing the stars in this new way, but they're also going to be reading this novel of the early astronauts and how they paved the way for the salvation of the human race.
And beyond that, the metaphor of new experiences and the metaphor of change and the metaphor of going through a trauma. We in this pandemic will have these moments of we get to go to a restaurant and sit down and have a meal again and we'll remember what it was like 15 months ago and have those moments. There's an interesting metaphor about beginnings and befores and afters in this book that I really enjoy. So we've completed the first book in the Lady Astronaut series. Mary Robinette Kowal, thank you for this story and these characters. I really encourage everybody to go on to the second book, but we're not, that's not what we're going to read for the next 4 weeks. It's Chip's turn to choose. So Curmudgeon Chip, what sort of book are we going to read for the next book in our book club?
You mean our trilogy? Our trilogy here in our book club? our trilogy begins a person who has not been in the news at all. His name is Bill Gates. Maybe you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. Former CEO of Microsoft.
Fought with bulldozers with Steve Jobs, as far as the rumor goes, that there was a bulldozer fight between the two of them. Go on. Yeah.
Some people have a life that will never live, Steve. Well, Bill Gates is, we know him now as the one of the owners of the Gates Foundation, certainly looking to solve some of the big picture ideas of its time. A person as wealthy as he is in the past may have used his resources to help a university. John D. Rockefeller helped found the University of Chicago. But what we're going to read is going to be a book that I think that may have helped us out at the beginning of our trilogy. It's basically a book on talking about climate change and some of the science and where we are today. This book was released on the 16th of February this year, 2021. The book is called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. And my hope is it's going to give us a big picture idea of where we're standing with the idea of climate change and maybe help our discussions and maybe help me rethink about the stories we read.
So this is the nonfiction book that you asked for when we started reading the Ministry for the Future, the cli-fi version of this story. So here we are, our first nonfiction book in Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. How about that?
Ooh, I'm excited. I read a lot of nonfiction, so not as much nonfiction as fiction, but still, I'm really looking forward to this.
And I read a lot of nonfiction too. I tend to enjoy it. We're going to read chapters 1 through 3, if you want to know a little bit about where we're standing. And we're going to read this over 4 weeks. My hope this will give us a wonderful way to discuss this topic that certainly is grand in scope and challenging.
All right. So that is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs That We Need by Bill Gates. We will start in on it next week. I hope everybody is going to join us and get a different perspective on this vast, giant thing that is our climate on Earth. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Pam.
I'm in.
It's weird that you do that now. That's how it goes now. So we'll get more information. If we don't have enough information, we can survive one more week and then we can get more information from the nonfiction version of this story. I would love to hear from you. How are you doing? What do you think? Are you ready for a nonfiction book? Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenthal.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Have a glorious 25th of May. We'll see you in the future.
Can we turn on Star Wars now, Steve?
Star Wars, Chip! Star Wars!